This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Corey Johnson. We're here every day bringing the latest news from the world of business and finance.
And the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 o'clock Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the ballooning federal budget deficit under President Trump will force the U.S. to borrow more than $1 trillion this year, risks worsening the frenzy behind the global sell-off in stock markets. Let's talk a little bit about this. Liz Capo McCormick is our bond and FX reporter here at Bloomberg News. Liz joining us on the phone in New Jersey. Liz, I'm so glad we're checking in with you. Tell us a little bit about this, because the numbers are kind of staggering in terms of our budget deficit and how they're going to be growing.
Right. Yeah, Carol, big numbers. And, you know, we kind of came into, even before the last presidential election, we just had a situation where budget deficits were looking to worsen. And now with the tax overhaul and this budget we got this week, it's going to go even faster. So we have forecasters saying the budget deficit is going to get to like about 5% of GDP by 2019. That's kind of, we haven't seen that since World War II. And like you mentioned, that means Treasury Department has to borrow a lot, and we've got forecasts from Wall Street that they'll kind of net issuance of bonds and notes, so it's going to be about $1 trillion and plus this year.
Well, let's back that up a little bit. So talk to me about the GDP prediction. Give us what you're saying is, what you're not saying is that their prediction is completely lacking in credibility.
Well, so let's just say that, like you say, the GOP and Trump's team is saying we're going to get enough economic growth that will fund, you know, this increased spending and the lost tax revenue. But if you don't kind of, and there are some, you know, private forecasters say we'll get some growth this year and next year. But going overall, if you just look at like the CBO, what they say, it's just not going to be enough. Our deficits are going to continue to expand and worsen by a lot over the next decade. It's not quite, you know, the growth isn't going to be quite there to make up for the lost revenue.
So, Liz, it's a little worrisome, too, right? Because we talk about, you know, the economy is growing and we've got this tax break. And this is, you know, I don't know that I would go as far as saying it's a sweet spot in terms of the economy, but we're not in a recession. Let's put it that way. So
Right. What
happens and our ability to service that debt? Do we need to, as a country, be worried about this? Because I feel like this issue has come and gone many times.
Right. Well, of course, since we are the holder of the world's reserve currency, treasuries are the risk-free security in the world, the Treasury Department will find buyers for their debt, Carol, right?
Yeah.
It's just a matter of at what price, meaning since that moves opposite to yield, we're going to see yields rise. So there's just no way the Treasury can sell all the amount of debt they need to, even just over the course of this year, what we're expecting, without likely yields rising. Unless, like you said, we're not in a situation where anyone's predicting a recession right now. That would change everything, but we're not there. We have, you know, we're in the late cycle, but we still have good growth. People bumped up growth for next year because of the tax cuts. And so we're not at that point where rates will go down. And, you know, just even to service the debt that we have, obviously, we're like anybody else, you pay interest on your debt. And as the U.S. government yields go up, they pay more interest. So you add that to entitlement spending, which is going up and up. And it's kind of like a little bit of a scary situation going forward.
Have there been failed auctions? What do we know about how much the market can actually take in?
Well, no, there's not going to be a failed auction, and there hasn't been in the U.S., and there won't be. You know, there will be buyers, you know, like I said, because, you know, we're just such a safe asset. Yeah, but the Treasury Department will have to pay up higher rates and, you know, higher yields. So that's what will happen. You know, like I said, it's not that they won't get the sales off. It's just going to be more costly for you and I, who ultimately pay it through higher taxes.
There's the payoff, right, Liz? I mean, that's the bottom line, potentially.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, it filters through. And again, like you said, the administration says, well, we're going to get, you know, higher growth, and it's not going to be as bad as the CBO projects, because they're not using the same dynamic scoring. But that's yet to be seen how it plays out. And even the private forecasters, like I said, Bank of America and others, are saying the deficit's going to expand a lot over coming years.
But it also might mean at some point that the government is going to once again have to make some choices about where they're going to spend money. And I think about this as we're talking about infrastructure spending. I think the president is planning to put out some details next week about that. There's so much in the pot to play with, correct?
Right, exactly. And, you know, some of my colleagues and I, we were reminiscing about, you know, remember the days under President Clinton, the bond vigilantes, when,
right.
you know, like, you know, they had to kind of change their policy. We're not there yet, but there's a point where, you know, if the market's, you know, just saying this deficit financing is a problem, you know, like you're saying, they might have to take heed and make some adjustments on how they kind of increase spending in the future.
It's a dramatic time, too. I thought it was interesting when you saw the political debate yesterday, when this sort of the issuance of all these Treasury notes as the market's melting down. And as you mentioned, right now the market's 140 points higher in the Dow right now, whipsawing right around that 200-day moving average for the S&P 500. But Rand Paul calling attention to the fact that this massive issuance of debt is a big one.
Right, and Corey, you might have seen, you know, me and my colleagues had a story yesterday, and one of our other colleagues that covers the Fed, you know, was in Philadelphia, and their Reserve President Patrick Harker mentioned, I think the market's waking up and realizing they didn't kind of bake this in the cake, that the debt issuance is going to double this year, right? You know, so you've got Fed officials mentioning that, like you
right.
said, Rand Paul, you know, tried to make a stand on the deficit, but the picture isn't quite changed yet still.
You also have a president who, you know, lived most of his life, you know, professional life using debt, you know, with some success and with some great failure. So, you know, it's kind of a different, maybe perhaps, take on debt. Liz Capel McCormick, bond and FX reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone in New Jersey. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
Low down and dirty tricks by Uber exposed in a trial in a suit between Uber and Google's driverless car program. A suit that was settled, much to our surprise, early this morning. The news came out that this suit's over, but we still learned a lot. Matt Larson's with us right now, Bloomberg Intelligence litigation analyst. Talk to me about this suit and why this was. Well, give us some of the scandalous details, because God knows there were some.
Yeah. Everybody wants to hear the scandal, which actually was, I think, in large part Waymo's motivation for filing the suit. So if you go back a couple of years, Uber hired away or retained Automoto. They purchased this company, Automoto, which was a lot of engineers that came out of Waymo, Google's self-driving car program, when an errant email was sent from somebody at Automoto, now Uber, to somebody at Waymo. They discovered that there were allegedly some trade secrets, some tech that was taken over to Uber. Waymo filed suit. Mud was thrown back and forth, and then we wound up in trial starting 5 days ago over whether or not Uber had made use of the trade secrets that that the former Google people had brought over.
I love the email. I love that Google's looking, hey, wait a minute. This is our stuff.
Yeah. They had done some due diligence. They had kind of sifted through things prior to the departure. But that was really the catalyst, is they said, oh, wait a second. This looks like Google stuff. It looks like you took it over. And, you know, they're competitors in the self-driving rideshare space, which is supposed to be huge, big market, especially over the next 10 years. So this was a big deal from a tech perspective for Waymo, and also kind of called into question, you know, what Uber was up to. Uber's made significant investments in a group out of Carnegie Mellon. So, you know, a lot of questions over where this tech came from and how it was going to be used.
I mean, bottom line, did they steal secrets from Google?
We will never know is part of it. And it kind of depends
on. That might not be true. Well, first of all, you never know what you're never going to know.
Yeah, you never know what you're never going to know. It's clear that some files were taken over, but it's also Uber had a very strong case about showing design arounds that no technology was used in the current iterations of Uber's self-driving car technology. And ultimately, the companies decided to settle mid-litigation. So they said, we're going to put put all grievances behind us. Interestingly, they settled right after Google had presented kind of the salacious part of its case. They had put Travis Kalanick up on the stand, kind of got some of the more aggravating details out there, but they hadn't gotten to the technical part of the case yet. And so that's when it settled, the question of whether or not this stuff is actually used in Uber's current iterations of its self-driving cars. Doesn't matter anymore. Companies settled. 0.34% of Uber's valuation goes to Waymo, about $250 million, $245 million.
Which brings the total cost of Waymo or of this acquisition by Google to about $1 billion.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the $680 million they paid to acquire the company, then the $250 million they had to spend to settle it, and Lord knows what a trial like this costs. But you got to figure what well. Since
yeah,
the lawyer's not available right now.
That's a good question. There are quite a lot of lawyers in the room. Each one's billing, likely between $700 to $1,000 an hour. The bulk of the cost when you start to get to this level is in the trial. There were pretty extensive pretrial motions. There were a lot of last-minute issues.
For?
Oh, I don't know. At least the tens of millions. I would say sub 50 million.
Wow.
But over
just
10.
Just for the suit.
Just for the lawsuit. A lot of lawyer time, a lot of eyeballs.
Wow. So, and there may be a criminal case. That's why I said we may find out after all if there was things.
Yeah, that's one of the most challenging things about trade secrets case. And also, strategically, if you're Waymo, even if the technical merits of your case are weak and you wind up settling, you've certainly sent a message to engineers or people who are looking to spin out and potentially get acquired. There's a talent retention issue there. Anytime you walk off with a company's trade secrets, there's a threat of criminal investigation. So Lewandowski, the employee who left Google and eventually joined Uber, was not named in the suit, but is still under scrutiny. He's not out of the frying pan quite yet. So
that's what I wondered. What was the precedent set as a result of this case, if there was any?
Yeah, I think, when you get a settlement, you don't have a much of a legal ruling. But in terms of just industry settlement, my view is Google achieved three things. One, they were able to disseminate a lot of FUD on mm-hmm. Uber, drag their name through the mud a little bit.
Right.
They're going to be competitors. So you get to knock down a competitor. Number two, you send a message to employees. Don't steal our stuff.
Right.
Or we're going to come after you. And number three, now they've got a little bit of a hedge strategically when you go into the self-driving car market. Not only do they have their own program, but they own a portion of Uber. And so, any gain of Uber's is a little bit of their gain as well, while it might eat away at some of their own market share.
Fascinating. Matt Larson, thank you so much for making sense out of the resolution here. Litigation analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence in our Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. Yeah, that's a safe assessment, I think, among investors trying to make sense of the return to volatility within the financial markets. She and her team, though, have had a cautious market outlook since mid-point of last year. Lizanne Saunders back with us, Senior Vice President, Chief Investment Strategist at Charles Schwab & Company. Lizanne joining us on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Liz, nice to have you back with us here. Tell us, back in the summer, I was reading some things. You guys were kind of saying, hang on a minute, this may not continue. You were sending up a cautionary sign at that point. So is this how you anticipated it would play out?
Well, maybe not the extent of the volatility this week, but, the fundamental initial kicker to this corrective phase was in keeping with what we were thinking. And it had multiple components to it, number one being that we were entering into the latter stages of the economic cycle, and those usually have some, sort of adjusting characteristics to them, not least being moving into more of an inflationary environment, which in turn meant tighter monetary policy, higher interest rates. And that tends to change the background environment for the market, tends to bring on some more volatility. And then as we got later in the year and we continued to see that suppressed level of volatility, that alone even suggested we were likely to see that followed by a pickup in volatility. And then the final kind of kicker to that more cautious view was investor sentiment, which in particular, as you ended the year last year, moved into the beginning of this year, we really did a 180-degree shift from really an era, this entire bull market of pessimism and skepticism, to much more overt optimism, if not even a lot of froth. So you combine those things, and it gave you the fundamental driver for this. And then, of course, you had the technical problems associated with the spike in volatility this week.
And listen, there's also this notion. We had David Redman on the show yesterday. He's a money manager out here in San Francisco and longtime tech investor. And he's like, look, with higher rates means your discounted cash flow analysis of future earnings just changes. You change that in your evaluation and analysis of companies, and stocks start to look more expensive because rates are higher and the comparisons, the other things one might invest in look more attractive as a result.
And there's nothing new about that. Tighter monetary policy in the past has always caused that problem and has changed often the landscape for the market and ushered in a period of higher volatility. And it isn't much different this time. I think what is unique in this cycle is that so far, anyway, until very recently, as the Fed was raising interest rates starting 2+ years ago and then more recently started to shrink their balance sheet, it had not actually had the effect of tightening financial conditions. But that has started to change. And that has had, always, and more recently now in this environment, has implications for the equity market. And I think that's coming to fruition.
How much tighter do you think it's going to get? I mean, how complicated is it going to get within the financial markets, within the business community? Where do we go, essentially?
So, obviously, we don't know the answer to that. And I think you have to sort of parse out the fundamental side of this from the technical side of this. And I don't think anybody knows yet how much further this has to go on the technical side. As far as where we go in inflation and monetary policy, there are structural, demographic, technological limitations on just how far up you would expect inflation to go. So we wouldn't anticipate that monetary policy has to run away from here, but we would expect it to actually start to have the effect of tightening financial conditions. And we don't think the Fed wants to really ratchet up interest rates here to get ahead of an inflation problem that they view to be a big one coming down the road. But we're just resetting expectations for where we are in the cycle. And we've been in this disinflationary environment, and we're no longer there.
Lizanne, though, it's tricky. I mean, historically, if we look at when the Fed starts to go on a raising rate cycle environment, we often do fall into recession. I mean, are you guys starting to kind of prep your clients that this could be a possibility within the next, I don't know, is it 1 year, 2 years, 18 months? I don't know.
No, I think we still have a decent runway because typically the market runs into trouble after the Fed is finished, not on the way up. And then keep in mind that bear markets tend to predate recession. So the stock market's a leading indicator. So I don't think what we're seeing this week is indicative of imminent risk of a rolling over in the economy. Now, the market itself can obviously do things like impact consumer confidence and business confidence, which all comes into play in terms of where we are in the economic cycle. But the good news is we were in an accelerating rate of growth. We were in an accelerating rate of earnings growth prior to this. Leading indicators had actually moved up in terms of the trajectory of improvement recently. And you have always, at least in the last three or four cycles, seen a rolling over in the leading indicators well in advance of the risk of recession starting to elevate. I just think we're re-rating a number of things, and maybe the most important one is the sentiment environment. And the big question now is, okay, we had all this sentiment froth predating this correction. How much of that gets worked off by virtue of how difficult this certainly is probably for some of the new investors that had chased this move recently?
I got a headline for you, Liz. That is, you talk about like closing the barn door after the horse is bolted. Fidelity is now barring the purchase of the ETF that moves inversely to the VIX. That is the SVXY ETF. Of course, it can't bar the trading in the other one because the other one completely collapsed this week,
and investors
lost
exactly all
their billions of dollars on the XIV exchange traded note. But I do think it's interesting that you had so many investors with billions of dollars invested in this this ETF and this exchange traded note trying to trade the VIX. And I wonder what that tells you about the environment we're in.
Well, one thing to just mention, not that I'm the corporate spokesperson on issues like this for Schwab, but not only are our consultants not allowed to recommend inverse or leveraged ETFs, we have been very vocal about saying to our investors, these are dangerous, and we recommend
that you do not move in them, and as recently as December, we actually sent letters out to those investors, clients that we saw had a position in any of these things to more pointedly remind them of the risks. So we have never been a fan of these products. So maybe that separates us a little bit.
Yeah.
Since you're not the corporate spokesperson, I won't congratulate you on that wonderful corporate governance. But that's a really great thing to do, is highlight some risks, even if your customers might have not been or might have been.
Yeah, you know, they were in the prospectus of these things, but, you know, well into the hundreds of pages before you got to that point, unfortunately.
All right. Lizanne, much appreciated. Great to get some time once again with you. Lizanne Saunders, she is Senior Vice President, Chief Investment Strategist at Charles Schwab and Company, joining us on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. That was really interesting.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Hard to be a bear, hard to be a bull in this market environment. It is time for the Drive to the Close. Eric Schoenstein is portfolio manager at Jensen Investment Management. Nearly $8 billion in assets under management. Still? I don't know. We'll have to ask him. Joining us from Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm not trying to be hard. It's just, I mean, it's been that kind of a week. What have you heard from your clients? What are they doing? Are people moving in and out in terms of the market?
We are not really hearing that from our clients as far as the move in and out. And I think that speaks to the fact that, you know, we do a lot of work with our clients to help them understand the benefits of long-term active management. And frankly, the fact is that corrections happen. They are inevitable in market cycles. And I think it's just more the fact that it has been a long time since we've had one that is causing sort of more of the fever that you see in terms of, you know, following markets on computers and things like that. But from our clients' perspective, they very much understand that this is a long-term play and that, you know, quite frankly, in some cases, this may make some of our opportunities that much more affordable.
Our Joe Weisenthal, who watches the markets for us, he just tweeted, the Dow appears to be moving in 100-point increments. Is there something about the trade that we're seeing, whether it's the volatility in one single day or the amount of the moves, anything that kind of stands out to you, Eric, and tells you something?
Well, I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind, you know, it's been a while, like I said, since we've had a spike in volatility. And frankly, I think this is a nice opportunity to be reminded that, you know, we did have a fairly strong complacency trade, if you want to call it that, for much of last year and even into January of this year. But one thing that it does kind of stand out, I was seeing some reports about the fact that, you know, there's a certain amount of investing that is done by humans, and what happens when you have large corrections, 3-4%, like we've had a couple of days in the last week or so, is the component that's human-driven is very much stays the same, but what happens is the automated component, the pieces that are done on algorithms and things, can tend to accelerate or decelerate depending upon when triggers are hit. And I think the point there would be that that's when it's most important to kind of almost turn off the TV or, and no offense, maybe not listen to all of the, you know, the panic, if you will, and stay focused on what your goals are and understand what your risk tolerances are when you think about investing. And that certainly is aligned with how we talk to our clients.
So what are they saying? I mean, are they, you know, new investors behave like new investors always, but I wonder what your clients are sort of saying in this opportunity. One of the things we've seen people do in the last, you know, few years is buy a lot of dips, but that looked like it was different behavior this week.
It does seem like it was some different behavior in the short term, but you know, we all know that the fact is that selling low and buying high really never works. That's never going to benefit anybody. And so, the way we've been talking about this is an opportunity to, you know, make sure you know what you own, make sure that high quality idea that you have been pursuing, makes sense and that you can see strong fundamentals in the businesses that you're investing in. And if you see that, then this represents perhaps some opportunity to continue to upgrade your portfolio to put in some protection against the downside, which is certainly something we believe high-quality companies can consistently do, is be that protection against volatility because of how strong they are fundamentally, regardless of what's happening in markets.
What changes, that, if any, have you guys been making, though, then, in portfolio allocations this week?
You know, this week has actually been relatively quiet for us from the standpoint of changes, and I think that's one of the distinctions about being a long-term investor is that you need to take the time to parse through what you think might be noise versus what you might think is reality. And you know, the good news is there are a lot of earnings that are being released because we are in the middle of the earnings season or nearing the end of it, and those are the opportunities for us to truly reassess the fundamentals of our business. Businesses to make sure that they're still very much in play, that these companies continue to execute their disciplines and have pricing power that will matter. They're taking advantage of things like the recent tax legislation to really sort of reset what might be an earnings trend for the future and frankly represent potential new opportunities rather than things that we need to sort of suddenly sell because something's going on from a broader market perspective.
And do you wish you had more cash to put at work here, or do you think it's maybe still time to wait, even though the market's up almost 389 points right now? That's the Dow, of course.
Well, I would certainly like to have the opportunity to put cash to work, and I think we have some opportunities in that regard. I think for most investors, you know, they may want to think about that as something that they do cautiously, just because, you know, that is an emotional thing to, you know, think about trying to put cash to work when things are sliding so dramatically. But, you know, if you can do it cautiously and if you can keep your eye on that long-term viability that the markets inevitably have, I think it's a good time to put some of that money to work.
Right, but still painful for those folks who are losing money in their portfolio. One person just tweeting right now I'm only going to be working until I'm 80. So, you know, that people are certainly feeling the pain. Eric Schoenstein, thank you so much. Portfolio Manager at Jensen Investment Management, nearly $8 billion in assets under management, joining us on the phone from Lake Oswego, Oregon.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
You move like they do. I've never seen anyone move that fast.
Shake. Shake.
All right, people, let's move like we've got a purpose.
Move it over. Slide it on over.
Company's called Movers and Shakers. They cost a little more, but that name cracked me up.
Bloomberg Markets, Movers and Shakers, with Carol Masser and Corey Johnson on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, let's get to your Movers and Shakers, winners and losers on this Friday afternoon. Carol Masser along with Corey Johnson. S&P 500, different tone today. Actually, the tone was kind of all over the place when you look at the equity markets. But by the end of the session, as Charlie mentioned, near our highs of the day, those closing equity averages. And what did that mean for the S&P 500? Most names in the index higher today, 412 to be exact. 92 lower, one unchanged. Corey, I want to talk a little bit about the online travel folks because Expedia, your number one decliner in the S&P 500, down.
Why
about...
Why do you have to be so negative? Really?
Really? You just stopped me cold. Anyway, Expedia down 15.5% today, yet Priceline down 2.3%. TripAdvisor down about 4.3%. Expedia, the number one decliner. TripAdvisor, the number two decliner. What happened is Priceline, TripAdvisor falling after Expedia's fourth quarter earnings missed, and that kind of tripped up all of those companies. Priceline, by the way, scheduled to report earnings on February 27th. You get TripAdvisor on Valentine's Day. But Expedia reported fourth quarter earnings and revenue that missed estimates. Investors reacting to that news today. So I'm not being negative. I'm just putting
out
some
real news.
You're
CEO of a company. How do you explain to your spouse that you've chosen to announce earnings on Valentine's Day?
Hi, honey, I bought you a present. Here's earnings.
Sorry, I got to work late. It was earnings.
No. See, actually, if you put them out on Valentine's Day and you get them out early, you can get all the work done and then go home for a Valentine's Day dinner or go out for a Valentine's Day dinner.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be skipping that this year.
No.
We saw Bitcoin up 5.6%, Ripple up 20% on the day, Ethereum up 8%, Litecoin up 8% as well. why do I bring these all together, all these cryptocurrencies? Because shares of NVIDIA were up 7% today, a big move, the second largest gainer in the S&P 500. Now, we remember we talked yesterday to David Redman right at the sort of the last hour after the closing day, talking about how he picked this company because they were doing great things. Well, one of the things that NVIDIA does is make chips that go into crypto mining hardware. The powerful NVIDIA chips are being used by Bitcoin miners, and it's created a shortage of the sort of high-end graphic chip cards, and that's been great things for NVIDIA. One of the analysts out there referred to their earnings, revenue, and gross margins as destroying the estimates.
Ouch.
And so across the board, really well-received results from NVIDIA that saw the revenues for this company grow at 34% year-over-year clip and very strong guidance going forward as well. So NVIDIA shares up, as I said, 6.7% on the day after reporting a very strong quarter and selling, you know, selling into video game high-end computers as well as Tesla vehicles and data centers and, yes, cryptocurrency miners.
All right, good to know. Hey, let's also – all right, I'll give you something a little bit more optimistic. The number one gainer in the S&P 500 today, shares of Mattel, the toy maker, up almost 8%, your number one gainer in the S&P 500. In terms of news, after the closing bell, we did get some news about the company naming their new chairman. They're saying – what's his name? Yinan Kreets. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing. And so he's a new chairman. So I guess there's stuff going on. But I think what's constantly at the back or the backstory for Mattel is whether or not ultimately they end up maybe getting together with Hasbro. So I think that's always constantly out there in the marketplace.
And let me give you one last one here. Do we have time for one? Yeah, we have time
sure,
for more. Web.com, not a company we talk about a lot, but getting just pummeled today. Stock was down 18% on the day the Jacksonville, Florida company does website solutions for small businesses, and just destroyed after an anemic recovery is cited by the fine folks over at B. Riley, and suggesting that this company's turnaround is just not imminent. Revenue growth in the last quarter was just 1% after negative 1% revenue changes, or you know, declines in the previous two quarters. So this anemic recovery. Continued anemic recovery of the phrases at B. Riley is pretty evident from these results. And the CFO is leaving. He's retiring effective January 30. And so that's the bad news out of Web.com in Jacksonville, Florida.
Let's talk a little bit about the volatility index report on this Friday. So I'm going to throw a couple of numbers at you. VIX was down 14% today, down almost 5 points, closing at 28.78. For the week overall, though, the VIX gained almost 66%. Its high point for the week was at 50, and its low point was at just under 17. So today, on this Friday, closing at 28.89. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Dave, you're up.
Hi, my name is Dave.
Wilson, where are you? Wilson!
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
We're going for a price on Wilson.
Open up the door, it's Dave!
Who?
Dave!
Hey, Mr. Wilson!
Dave Wilson joins us right now, as if you couldn't tell, with his stock of the day.
And it's Civitas Solutions, Corey. It's a Boston-based company that runs what's known as the Mentor Network. The network provides healthcare and other services to individuals with special needs and their families. Civitas was founded in 1980 and went public in September 2014. The ticker symbol is the first four letters of the name, CIVI. The shares gained as much as 78% through December 2015 and then tumbled in response to disappointing results. Today, Civitas suffered its biggest loss since going public after reporting fourth quarter figures. If you just looked at last quarter's performance, you'd wonder why. Revenue beat the average analyst estimate in the Bloomberg survey for the first time in 9 quarters. Earnings also topped projections. Trouble is that Civitas's outlook for this year wasn't what investors were looking for. The company reduced its forecast for adjusted EBITDA, that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. On a conference call, the company attributed the cut to higher labor costs. And the prediction sent shares of Civitas as low as $11.15 today. And bear in mind, this is a company that went public at 17. Stock closed at 11:35 for a loss of 23%.
And they approved a buyback, right, of up to $25 million.
Absolutely. So those shares will be a whole lot cheaper today than they were yesterday.
Interesting, Dave. CIVI is the Bloomberg stock of the day from Bloomberg Stocks columnist Dave Wilson. Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays, 2 o'clock Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio. And follow us on Twitter. She's at Carol Masser, and I'm at Corey TV.